Okay, well, let's go ahead and turn to our text for this evening then. We're in 2 Kings. We're looking at the life of Ahaz, the terrible. That's kind of my designation for him. I don't think you'll find that designation in too many other places, but Ahaz gives us a good example of what not to do. We're in Ahaz chapter 2 Kings chapter 16. We are also going to be flipping over to the book of 2 Chronicles. Where is it? 28. So if you want to keep a thumb in 2 Chronicles chapter 28, we'll be going back and forth there. We've looked at Ahaz's life. How would you make a possessive out of a one of Ahaz's, I guess it would be, Ahaz's life. And tell me some things that we have learned about Ahaz. His name starts with A. That's good. He was a wicked king. What kind of things did he do that earned him the designation a wicked king? Yeah, he sacrificed his sons, and we saw that it was plural, so there were more than one. He sacrificed his sons to the gods of the nations around Israel. What else has he done? Yeah, interesting little thing up there. Dan's reading the timeline and he sees a blank spot, which we're going to get to here. Because there's a really interesting little historical tidbit about Ahaz the king. And, but if you'll hold off, we'll get to that one, okay? Because what we have dealt with so far have just been these first couple of years of Ahaz's reign. Because we've primarily been dealing with things that pertain to him and a conflict between Ahaz and the union of Syria and the northern kingdom of Israel. Syria is being ruled over by a fellow named Rezin, R-E-Z-I-N, and the northern kingdom of Israel is being ruled over by this fellow, Pekah, the son of Remaliah. Pekah and Rezin have teamed up against Ahaz, and much of what we read in the biblical text summarizes these first couple of years of his reign. Here's why I say that. Because Pekah dies 3 years into Ahaz's reign. So a lot of the things that deal with Pekah and Rezin and Assyria, they all happen while Pekah's alive, which means they all happen here in the first 3 years of Ahaz's reign. And so we looked at an invasion of Judah that happened. Syria and the northern kingdom of Israel came down to Judah and attacked it, but they couldn't destroy Jerusalem and overthrow Ahaz. They did, however, walk away with a whole bunch of plunder and a whole bunch of captives, and some of the captives went up to Syria, and some of them went to Israel. What happened to the captives that went to the northern kingdom of Israel? Test your memory. I know it's been a couple of weeks here since we've been together, but they went to the northern kingdom, and what happened to them when they got there?
Wasn't that where they got killed?
Nope, that's a different one. When they get to Samaria, three prophets come out and say, "You're not bringing these captives here. This is wrong." And some of the leaders of the northern kingdom stand up and say, you know what, send them back home. So they clothe them, they feed them, and they send the captives back home. So God intervened so that many of those captives were sent back to Judah, and so Ahaz was not overthrown. Now, being such a wicked guy, why is it that God is allowing Ahaz to continue on the throne? Because he's a descendant of David. This is in faithfulness to the Davidic covenant. And so God's being faithful to Ahaz, even though Ahaz is not the one that's receiving the benefit of it. This is all for the benefit of Christ, that God is being merciful here to Ahaz. We also read about, or we started to, where are we going here? Verse 7 of 2 Kings chapter 16 says, "So Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, 'I am your servant and your son. Come up and rescue me from the hand of the king of Assyria, and from the hand of the king of Israel who are attacking me.' Ahaz also took the silver and gold that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasures of the king's house, and he sent a present to the king of Assyria." So Ahaz is being confronted by this alliance between the northern kingdom and Syria. Who does Isaiah the prophet tell him to trust? This should be an easy answer, right? This is like Sunday school answer. God, the Bible, Jesus, right? Okay. Yeah, Isaiah comes along in Isaiah chapter 7 and gives him this great prophecy. It says, trust in the Lord. If you're not firm in faith, you won't be firm at all. God is going to deliver you. Don't worry, I'm going to break the power of Syria, and I'm going to break the power of Ephraim, the northern kingdom, because in 65 years, Ephraim is not even going to be a people any longer. And he gives that prophecy, and he says, all right, ask the Lord for a sign, whatever sign you'd like, be it as high as heaven above or as low as the earth beneath. Whatever you want, God's going to do to prove that he's going to save you out of the hand of these two kings. And what does Ahaz ask for? What does Ahaz ask for? Money? Nope, he doesn't ask for money. It's a little bit of a trick question. And this is in Isaiah chapter 7 that you... Ahaz says, I'm not going to ask the Lord for a sign. We're not supposed to test the Lord God. So, that's true. God says, don't put the Lord your God to the test. But when God says, ask for a sign, is that testing God? No, that's just following in obedience. And so Ahaz doesn't even want to obey God on this. And so what was the sign then that God did give Ahaz? Even though you won't ask for a sign, behold, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Eldon? Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and you shall call his name Emmanuel. This was God's promise to Ahaz and Judah, that God had not abandoned them. They were not going to be destroyed, and the birth of this child would prove it. So, in prophecy, there are almost always two referents. Not always, but many times. Two referents. One, an immediate referent, and one, an ultimate referent. So there was a child born, probably to Isaiah, because many of his children were as signs to the people of Israel. So there was a child born to Isaiah very soon after that prophecy was given that would be the sign to Judah that God had not abandoned them. Ultimately, there's another child born, and his name is Jesus. And he proves to us that God is with us, that God is not going to destroy us. If we're in Christ, God is for us. So there's Ahaz. He wickedly rejects God's provision. He's not faithless, even though Isaiah challenged him, said, if you're not firm in faith, you won't be firm at all. And Ahaz says, well, I don't even want to be firm in faith, not in Jehovah anyway. So who does he call on for help? What we just read in 2 Kings 16, who does Ahaz go to for help instead of trusting Jehovah God? We're looking at 2 Kings 7 or 16, verses 7 and 8. Who does Ahaz go to? Assyria. The king of Assyria, right? He forms an alliance. He tries to get into a peace agreement with the king of Assyria and says, hey, this guy, Syria, Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, they're attacking me. I'm going to give you this big present. Come help me. Where does he get the money for the present? From the temple. He goes and pillages the temple. takes all the treasuries out of the temple and all the treasuries of the king's house, and he hands them over to Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria. And verse 9, the king of Assyria listened to him. The king of Assyria marched up against Damascus and took it, carrying its people captive to Kir, and he killed Rezin. And there's the end of Syria. There's no king now left in Syria. He's been done away with by Assyria. So naturally, you sent this big present to Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria. He's currently capped in Damascus, the capital of Syria, because he just defeated Syria, your enemy. What would you do? We're going to go visit him and say, thank you very much. We're going to grovel at his feet and say, wow, it was very nice of you to come and do that, even though I just gave you a huge amount of money to do it. But he has pledged himself as a vassal state. Now Judah is subservient to Assyria. And so in verse 10, it says, Ahab went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria. So he makes the trek all the way up north to Syria to meet Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria. Once again, try not to get these two confused. I know it's crazy. You wish these ancient nations would name themselves something different. I mean, it's not hard to keep United States and Mexico separate, right? But here we have these two countries, Syria and Assyria. Syria is the one just north of Israel. If this is your map, you've got Israel down here. This is Syria. Assyria is over here. But it's a big dog nation right now. They are expanding. They've come over. They've conquered the Hittite Empire up here. They've come down now. They've conquered Syria. And they've got plans to keep going south. Tiglath-Pileser has his eyes on another big dog south. Who's south of Israel? If Israel's here and this is Syria, who's down here?
Egypt.
Assyria has their eye on Egypt. If you can conquer Egypt, you've got the whole world. They've already got everything just about to the east. Now they want to move west, okay? So Tiglath-Pileser comes and he conquers, and there's his name right there. He's the king of Assyria. He conquers Syria and he's camped in Damascus. So Ahaz marches up to Damascus with his entourage to meet Tiglath-Pileser and to profusely thank him for intervening. So Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and he saw the altar that was at Damascus. So, just a guess, is this altar to Jehovah God? Probably not. This is Syria, not Israel, right? I mean, it was hard enough to find the right altar in Judah because they kept building all these false ones. You're not likely going to find a true altar to the true God in Syria. So he goes up there, he sees this amazing altar, and look at what he does. King Ahaz sent to Uriah the priest a model of the altar and its pattern, exact in all its details. And Uriah the priest built the altar in accordance with all that King Ahaz had sent from Damascus. So Uriah the priest made it before King Ahaz arrived from Damascus. So Ahaz emails the AutoCAD programs of this new altar back to Jerusalem. And he says, Uriah, I want this thing manufactured before I get back. Who builds it for him? Uriah the what? The priest? Priest of what? We can fill in a blank there. You're thinking the right direction. Who is this guy? He's probably the high priest, or he's at least one of the Levitical priests. But what does he build for the king? He builds an altar to a pagan god so the king can worship at it. It gets better. When the king came from Damascus, this is verse 12, the king viewed the altar, and then the king drew near to the altar and went up on it. And he burned his burnt offering and his grain offering and poured his drink offering out of his peace offerings on the altar. See, wow, what a confusion. What's all this stuff about peace offerings, grain offerings, and blood offerings? Where does that come from? Go ahead, Elton. That comes from the Levitical law, doesn't it? But he's doing all these things that God commanded the kings to do, and where is he doing it? He's doing it on a pagan altar. Because which altar was supposed to receive the sacrifices? Elden? The temple. Who built the temple? Let's review our history. Okay, so Solomon builds this temple. Why should we give precedence to Solomon's temple any more than we should give precedence to anyone else's temple? I mean, that's not very inclusive and tolerant of you, Elden. We're going to pick on Elden. Why should we give precedence and say that God wants his people sacrificing at that temple, on that altar, rather than this new fancy altar from Damascus? Obviously, you're not going to go to Leviticus for this, right? Because Leviticus was written long before the temple was built. So what historical event can you think of that signifies this is God's altar? Okay, Solomon dedicates the temple. All right, we're getting closer, but do you think the priests probably dedicated this pagan altar too? Yeah, you bet they did. They had ceremonies for this kind of stuff. Solomon was dedicating. God falls upon the temple, fills the whole place, so the priests have to run out because they can't even do their work in there because God's there. And fire came down and consumed the altar, the sacrifice that was on the altar. That was God saying, "This is mine." What you built in Leviticus, what you Israelites built, the tabernacle and all of its furnishings, I'm transferring that sanctity to this new temple. So yes, Solomon, I approve of your temple. It's actually God that gave David the designs and moved in him to build it and allowed Solomon to build it. So when God descended on that temple, he sanctified it and said, "This is where you worship me, nowhere else, on no other altar." The one Solomon built, that one of bronze. All right? But here Ahaz thinks he's got a better idea. He thinks he knows how to worship God better than God does. It's a good thing we never do that kind of stuff, isn't it? Do we ever think we can worship God better than God can tell us how to worship him? Yeah, oh yeah, sure we do. Sure we do. Come up with all kinds of creative ways to do it. But Ahaz takes this to a whole new level. So he brings this altar in, he offers his offerings on it. He's got the help of the priest, so that makes it even look more authentic or more legitimate. This is where the priest should have stepped up and said, "Not a chance, Ahaz. No way are we bringing in a pagan altar to this place. No way are you offering sacrifices on anything but the right altar." I mean, it was just a couple of generations. Let's look back here. Ahaz's daddy was Jotham. Jotham's daddy was Uzziah. What happened to Uzziah? He tried to go in and burn incense himself. And he became a leper. And the priest said, "Nope, you get out of here." But now, here we are just a generation later, 20 years later, and the priests are helping Ahaz how quickly things slide. So how long does it take for a people to go from faithful to faithless? Not even one generation, right? But yeah, one generation. We're all only ever one generation away from apostasy if we don't strive to maintain it, strive to pass it along, okay? So, verse 14, not only is he offering his offerings on this new altar, verse 14, the bronze altar that was before the Lord, he removed from the front. Where am I at? Sorry. Back up to the beginning of the verse. I'm going to try to read this again. And the bronze altar that was before the Lord, he removed the house of the Lord and put it on the north side of his altar. You know the setup of the temple? You had the doors. The doors that barred off the court allowed to go in there. And they would bring their sacrifice to those doors, and right inside the doors there was an altar for for washing, and there was the bronze altar of burnt sacrifice. Okay, Solomon had that big sea of bronze that he could fill with water, and from that they could fill up. There were numerous bronze carts they could push around. They could have little carts of water all over the place to wash the sacrifice before they burn it. But all of the sacrifices had to go on that altar, and it was right in front of the doors of the temple. Because the picture was, you're approaching my temple, you're looking straight down the doors barring the way to the temple. Yeah, you have the court of the Gentiles, you have the court of the men, or the women, and then the court of the priests, and you have to go through one way. There's only one path in here, and between you and that temple is this altar of sacrifice. You have to sacrifice before you can go into worship. And even then, you're not allowed inside there. You have to stay outside at a safe distance because you're not worthy to come into God's presence. And so he takes that altar that God had sanctified and he pushes it off to the north side and he puts his altar here. This is classic illustration of us putting our works and our merit and our creativity in place of what God has given us. It's us trying to replace God's grace with our merit, with our works, with our goodness. Because Ahaz looked at that altar in Damascus and he said, wow, that's bigger and fancier and better looking than the one we've got. Surely God would be more pleased with something bigger and fancier and better looking than what we've got. I mean, after all, when he gave instructions for that tabernacle, we were just a nomadic people wandering about through the desert. We didn't have all the technological means. We didn't have the riches we have now. So let's build something bigger and let's build something better. Except that God said, no, that's mine. And now you're pushing my grace and my mercy off to the side, and you want to try to establish your own pattern of worship. So, he moves the altar off to the side. Verse 15. And King Ahaz commanded Uriah the priest, saying, on the great altar burn the morning burnt offering, and the evening grain offering, and the king's burnt offering, and his grain offering, with the burnt offering of all the people of the land, and their grain offering, and their drink offering. And throw on it all the blood of the burnt offering and all the blood of the sacrifice. But the bronze altar shall be for me to inquire by. This, why do you think he keeps the old one around at all?
He knows God's already angry.
He knows God's already angry? I don't think he does.
But he's not taking the chance.
Oh, so he's walking the fence. Yeah, exactly. Ahaz is this kind of guy that thinks, well, I'm going to worship in every possible way that I can see around me because apparently these people have got something. And so I'm going to worship the way Syria does, and I'm going to worship the way Ammon does, and I'm going to worship the way the Moabs do, and I'm going to keep the worship of Jehovah. So I'm going to keep this altar over here just to keep Jehovah happy. Can we walk like that in life? Well, let's rephrase the question then. You're right, it's not long. Does God accept that kind of commitment? Not in the slightest. Faith in Christ means I'm either in or I'm out. I'm either committed or I'm not. There's no such thing as half commitment. There's no such thing as, well, I'll give it a try. Oh boy, something drives me batty is when I hear people sharing the gospel and they say, come on, give Jesus a try. What can it hurt? I say, oh, why don't you just take the gospel and rip it to shreds and throw it away? Because you're not preaching it anyhow. That's not the gospel. You don't give Jesus a try. You either believe it or you don't. You're either repentant and coming before God for his mercy, or you don't think you need it. There is no fence riding here. But Israel and Judah have been riding the fences for centuries, and that's why it's culminating in Ahaz. They've been going back and forth, and I love that question. God even asks his people, how long will you be back and forth between two decisions? If God is God, worship him. If not, go off and worship something else. And that was way back in Joshua's time. Because he answers and says, as for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord. No questions, no wishy-washiness, no riding the fence. We're all in for Jehovah. We're going to do it his way as best we can. Ahaz doesn't like that idea, so he's going to try to be the best of all worlds. This is the Old Testament version of our modern-day inclusive society. We want everybody to be happy. So if you have immigrated from some other country into Judah, it's okay. You can still worship your God right in our temple. We'll open it up for you. Now, how many churches do we hear of opening up prayer rooms for Muslims to come in, feel comfortable praying? You know, I don't in any way think we should mistreat people of other faiths. But at the same time, we don't ever say that we think they're right. Because if Christ is right, then he's only right. And there is no other way. Okay, verse 16. Uriah the priest did all this as King Ahaz commanded. There's a big shame. Uriah should have stood up against that, said, no, this is not for you to do. Verse 17, King Ahaz cut off the frames of the stands. These are the little basins of water, the carts that Solomon made to push water around the temple area so they could put these carts in different places and have them there so you can wash the sacrifices. So he takes, removed the basin off them. He took down the sea from off the bronze oxen that were under it and put it on a stone pedestal. So here's this magnificent bowl that Solomon made. The thing was huge. It was 10 feet across. It was 4 feet deep. I think it could hold 1,000 baths of water. I'm forgetting my conversions at the moment, so I can't think of exactly how much water that is. But let's just say it's a lot of water. And it's set on these amazingly, intricately carved 12 bronze oxen. 4 of them facing each direction. And the bowl sat on their backs. And so Ahaz takes that bowl. I'd like to know how many men it took to lift it, or what size the crane was that was. You know, it's like those cranes over there building the grain silos across the freeway. Those things are huge. You see them lifting stuff into place. It's kind of amazing. But he lifts up the bowl. He takes the oxen out. He sets the bowl on a pedestal of stone. Verse 18. The covered way for the Sabbath that had been built inside the house and the outer entrance for the king, he caused to go around the house of the Lord because of the king of Assyria. So here he's even altering the buildings around the temple in order to accommodate the king of Assyria. And so instead of recognizing that God is king of Judah, and that Ahaz is just supposed to consider himself a vassal to Jehovah God, now he's changing up the entire city and even the organization of the temple precincts to prioritize the king of Assyria. Because guess what happens when you sell yourself as a slave? You have to listen to your master, right? Ahaz has now sold himself to the king of Assyria. Now he's going to have to do whatever the king of Assyria says, because he's now a slave. This is, it becomes a great picture of sin. Not that sin is a great thing, but it becomes a great picture of sin. When we sell ourselves to sin, whatever it's promising us, it might deliver it partially, but in the end, it always only delivers servitude, slavery, and bondage. So whenever we trade God's righteousness for something we think like security or stability or something like that, financial security, whenever we trade what God tells us to do for something like that, we always wind up in greater bondage than we were. I want you to go to 2 Chronicles at this point. So if you look at 2 Chronicles chapter 28, verse 16, Second Chronicles chapter 28 verse 16, we are now after the time that Ahaz asked Assyria for help against Israel. But we're still having trouble. And so verse 16, at that time King Ahaz sent to the king of Assyria for help. For the Edomites had again invaded and defeated Judah and carried away captives. So not only had he been attacked by Rezin and Pekah, but what's happened to Rezin and Pekah? They died. They died right here. Probably when Assyria came in and defeated Syria and killed Rezin, he also killed Pekah, the son of Remaliah. Okay. Hoshea We're going to see him in a little bit. This guy, Hoshea, actually killed Pekah, but it was right about that same time. And so after that, he's safe from the Israelites and from the Syrians, but now he's having trouble from the Edomites from the south. The Edomites had invaded and defeated Judah and carried away captives, and the Philistines had made raids in the cities, in the Shephelah and the Negeb of Judah, and had taken Bethshemesh, Ajalon, Gederoth, Soko with its villages, Timnah with its villages, and Gimzo with its villages, and they settled there. So Judah is now losing many cities and villages on the southern end, and God is using the enemies of Israel to push things back. All that expansion, all of that progress that they made under Uzziah has been erased. And now Judah's being pushed back into this little narrow channel of land again. And for the Lord humbled Judah because of Ahaz, king of what? Ahaz, king, go ahead, say it out loud. King of Israel, right? Verse 19, the Lord humbled Judah because of Ahaz, king of Israel. Wait a second. Now, we are in a portion of the histories. Israel is a technical term that refers to which country? The northern kingdom. Is Ahaz a king of the northern kingdom or the southern kingdom? He's a king of the southern kingdom, but right there, what does the chronicler call him? King of Israel, the northern kingdom. Dan, you were asking about this gap. Ahaz sells himself to Tiglath-Pileser to be delivered from Pekah and the king of Syria, Rezin. Tiglath-Pileser comes in, he kills Rezin. Pekah is assassinated by Hoshea. What do you think Tiglath-Pileser now does? Who's his friend? Who just paid him a bunch of money? Ahaz did. How do you reward your friends? You give them more positions. Tiglath-Pileser comes in, and now since he's in charge of everything, he appoints Ahaz as king, not only of the southern kingdom, but of the northern kingdom. We're going to see that Hoshea takes the throne in the 13th year of Ahaz. So there is about a 10-year gap here where there is not a northern king sitting on the throne in the north. Ahaz is now king of both kingdoms because he sold himself to Tiglath-Pileser. He's the king of Israel. But God is upset with him because he's trusting Tiglath-Pileser rather than trusting God. He had been very unfaithful to the Lord. So Tiglath-Pileser came, king of Assyria, came against him and afflicted him instead of strengthening him. So Tiglath-Pileser rescues Ahaz from Syria and Pekah. He makes Ahaz king of the northern kingdom as well. Now, sometime during here, all of the other nations around Israel, like Edom, the Philistines, they start getting rowdy. And they're invading Judah. They're taking away cities. So what does Ahaz do? He calls out to Tiglath-Pileser again. So why is it that in one book, the book of Kings, it says Tiglath-Pileser helped him, and in this book it says Tiglath-Pileser came against him and afflicted him instead of strengthening him? Because it's a different situation. The first time, Tiglath-Pileser did come in and help him. Now this time, I think what happens, and this is just me and my hopefully sanctified imagination, you put somebody in charge of a task. And they keep coming to you saying, I need help with this. I need help with this. I need help with this. What are you going to do? I say, you know what? I thought you could handle this. I thought you could take care of this. It's sweeping the floor. This is pretty easy stuff. Why do you have to keep calling? I'm trying to take care of these things over here. I need you. I just made you king of Israel. I just made you king of both your kingdom and the one next to you. And you're supposed to keep control of things in this area of the world for me. But you're not doing it. And so, you know what? There's going to be trouble for you. So, I think what happens is, because Ahaz is not able to maintain control of his region, he's got the Edomites coming up from the south, he's got the Philistines coming over from the west, and so Tiglath-Pileser, it says, came against him and afflicted him instead of strengthening him. Verse 21, for Ahaz took a portion from the house of the Lord and the house of the king and of the princes and gave tribute to the king of Assyria, but it did not help him. How did he gain the king of Assyria's favor the first time? A bribe, a huge present. He pillaged the house of the Lord to get it. Does it help him again? No. Here's the fun thing about sin. What you give it the first time will never be enough. You'll have to sell yourself to it. Sometimes we call this the law of diminishing returns. We talk about this a lot when it comes to substance abuse. You use a drug for the first time, you get this great experience. That doesn't just apply. Now, I understand there's some differences because there's some physical things going on in your brain when you take substances like that, but sin operates in a very similar way. It will promise you everything. And then when you give into it, you give into temptation, you say, yep, I'll do it. It only delivers a little bit of what it promised. And it says, oh, if you really want what I promised, you have to give me more and more and more. And so that's where Ahaz is at. He didn't trust the Lord. He thought he could do it himself. He thought that his way was better. And so he trusts the king of Assyria. But now the king of Assyria is afflicting him rather than helping him. So, going back to 2 Kings, chapter 16. He's stripped the temple down of all of its stuff. Oh, wait, no, I'm sorry. Go back to Chronicles. There was something I wanted to read there. 2 Chronicles 28, verse 22. So the king of Assyria has now not helped him, and in fact afflicted him more. But he's already stripped the temple of all of its valuables. So verse 22, in the time of his distress, he became yet more faithless to the Lord. In the beginning, he held on to that altar. And he said, you know what, I'll go inquire of the Lord by that altar. Because, you know, I still want to keep God around. But now it's time to push God completely out of the picture. Don't make any mistake about this. People that walk the fence eventually will push God out of the picture, one way or the other. There is no such thing as having two gods. Jesus said it, you can't serve two masters. God commanded it in the Ten Commandments. You shall have no other gods before me, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. We can't have our heart divided two ways. And so people that try to walk the fence and serve two gods will eventually reject the true one. And they'll go after the false one. And that's what Ahaz is doing, unless God intervenes. Isn't that great when God does that, though? He just comes down and he says, you know what, you're done with this nonsense. He grips your heart, squeezes it, turns it the right direction. And you say, you know what, forget all that other stuff, I'm done. I'm going to follow you. So I don't want to try and make it sound like God's grace never intervenes, because that's the only thing that changes the situation. Left on our own, when we walk the fence, we will choose the false God over the true one. But that's what makes God's grace so amazing. So in the time of his distress, he became yet more faithless to the Lord. This same King Ahaz, for he sacrificed to the gods of Damascus that had defeated him and said, because the gods of the kings of Syria helped them, I will sacrifice to them that they may help me. But they were the ruin of him and all Israel. And Ahaz gathered together the vessels of the house of God and cut in pieces the vessels of the house of God. And he shut up the doors of the house of the Lord, and he made himself altars in every corner of Jerusalem. You know what? It's not even enough now that we're going to push God out of his own temple. We're just going to shut that temple down. No more worship of Jehovah at all. Instead, we're going to put up altars all over the place in Jerusalem. You can worship any other god you want to, except the true one. And in every city of Judah, he made high places to make offerings to other gods, provoking to anger the Lord, the God of his fathers. Now the rest of his acts and all his ways from first to last, behold, they are written in the book of the kings of Judah and Israel. And Ahaz slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the city in Jerusalem, for they did not bring him into the tombs of the kings of what? Israel. No, they wouldn't bury him in the northern kingdom with the kings of Israel, so they buried him in Jerusalem. Here's just another hint that Ahaz, for a time, was ruling over Israel. By the time Ahaz dies, Hoshea has made himself king of Israel, which is also probably why they wouldn't bury him up there. Hezekiah, his son, ruled in his place. So we've covered the life of Ahaz the Terrible. It's been a full life. I mean, for only reigning 16 years, this guy did a lot of damage. When he dies, the house of the Lord is completely closed up. All of the vessels of the house of the Lord have been cut to pieces or sent off to foreign kings as tribute. So that leaves the temple in a pretty desperate situation. It's a shame God got defeated, isn't it? God's going to raise up a hero. God always does. You know, sometimes we look, and I heard when Billy Graham passed away, they said there'll probably never be another man like Billy Graham. And so that may be true, that may not be true, but you know what the difference is they're looking at it from a worldly perspective because it wasn't Billy Graham. The Spirit of God was at work through him, to be sure. But God will raise up another guy like him to meet the need of the time. And until we need it, we won't see it. But you can be assured that when we need it, the guy will be there. Because God will raise up a hero to intervene. And he's going to do that here. And it's going to be in the form of young Hezekiah, who actually is not quite so young when he takes the throne. But we'll take a look at that next time. Any questions about Ahaz the Terrible? Now I know you're all going to be hoping that your grandchildren, Ahaz, will be the first name on the name list when they're born, right? Why don't you name him Ahaz? You know, we were thinking about John. No, Ahaz, great name. Any questions? All right. Our Father, we thank you for the example.